Have you noticed that politicians struggle to enact the things they run on? That regardless of who wins elections, lawmakers cannot pass whatever legislation they like? This is the Overton window at work. The idea, coined by the Mackinac Center's Joe Overton, describes the range of ideas that are politically possible at any moment. And on the Overton Window podcast, we look at ideas as they move from being unthinkable to plausible to policy, and talk to the people who change what is politically possible. Now, behind any major social movement, you're going to find an effort to persuade, or a successful effort to persuade a lot of people. And so today we're going to talk about persuasion. In fact, we're going to talk about it with the author of a new book, Josh Bando, who wrote How to Get What You Want. Josh is a former speechwriter, TEDx speaker, and policy analyst. Welcome, Josh.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be back. Really appreciate it.
How do you get what you want?
Persuasion. And persuasion is the difference between having a good idea and having others embrace it, which in the policy space is extremely important. Lots of policy folks have great ideas. And to get those ideas embraced, adopted, enacted into law, and acted on, you need persuasion.
So that's not convincing people that they were wrong. At least how you just defined it. What's the difference?
100%. So I think in order to understand what persuasion is, get there in just a second, we have to understand what it's not. And there are two really common misconceptions of persuasion. The first is that persuasion is all about winning. And James, if I win against you, what does that make you?
Probably the loser.
A loser. And when someone makes
or
you feel like
someone
a loser,
or someone who went on the winning side.
Could be. Usually, though, when we try to make, when I try to win against you, it's usually at a cost to you. So I'm going to come back to what you just said, because there is something there. So I do think most people are like, I want to win. And if that means you lose, hey, you know, whatever. That just makes you a loser, which is, that stinks. The second misconception of persuasion is that it's about convincing someone to think just like you. And the trouble arises when we first think about the Latin root of the word convince. It actually means to vanquish or to conquer. And conquest is barbaric. It's not persuasive. So what is persuasion? Persuasion is shared action. It's shared because it's something that we voluntarily do with others. And it's action because it's about getting things done. So to go back to your little, you know, sort of like nudge back at me, which is winning in the right way, which is that we voluntarily do it with others. So it's, you know, it is a win in the sense that there's success, but I'm not winning against you. Maybe it's I'm winning with you.
Which is why, even though the book is titled How to Get What You Want, much of it is focused on helping to, is focused on what other people want.
100%, because they have to share action with you. Otherwise, it's just force. And that goes right to the heart of what I call the persuader's mindset. And maybe I'll kind of capture it in a story from an intern a couple of summers ago. Really smart kid nice kid too, went to a good school. And he thought that the best way to succeed professionally and personally was to raise his hand, talk a lot, make it all about him and showcase how smart he was, even to the point where he would interrupt other interns, colleagues, me, kind of mid-sentence. That aligns with our wiring because we're wired to think all about ourselves. The problem is that that's not persuasive because whenever he would do this, it would just frustrate me. So the persuader's mindset asks you to flip this and go from the me first mindset that's wired into us to put them first and adopt a them first mindset, which this intern did extremely well. He, over the course of summer and a couple little, you know, sort of Yoda-like conversations from me, helped him understand that this actually wasn't so effective. And then, in fact, you kind of had to flip things. It was funny that one time he came in, he said, I never guess what happened last night. And I said, what's that? And he said, well, I was talking to my girlfriend and she's having a problem with her internship. And I did that thing again. I just kept interrupting her and she got really annoyed. And she said, why can't you just listen? And then like light bulb went back off. He was like, oh, wait, okay. So he listened, helped understand her situation, put her first, and helped her figure out a plan to make things better. And the happy news was that as John, this is the intern, kind of flipped things around, he outperformed all the interns such that he gave us everything that we needed, which meant that he got a promotion and the opportunity to stay on board. So you got to flip things, put them first, because that's how you get what you want.
How do you change your mindset from going from me to we?
Yeah, so you have to understand that there are missionary and mercenary reasons to put them first. The missionary reason is it's the right thing to do. When someone genuinely, authentically engages you and understands you, that feels good and that builds connection. There's also the mercenary reason, which is that it's the best way to get what you want, because when you understand somebody else's interests and goals, there's always going to be overlap, and usually a lot more overlap than you could ever expect. So you just have to look for it. So you do that and you find usually a couple, often more than a couple ways where your interests and their interests overlap. And that's where you press on and that's where you share action.
It seems like it's difficult to understand what other people actually want, what they care about, to get beyond just the appearances and to really understand what they're talking about. How do you develop that skill?
You got to become what I call the ultimate listener. And listening's really hard because we like to talk about ourselves. Talking about ourselves generates the same sensations in our brain as sex and money. So it feels really good. So we're also wired to survive, and talking and thinking about ourselves helps us survive. It just impedes thriving. So you flip this by, wait for it, listening. The trouble is that we're not actually taught how to listen. Like, who teaches you to actually pause and listen? So the first step, and this is, you know, kind of what the intern did, just passively listen, in this case to his girlfriend. What's going on, honey? Right? Like, tell me, please. And then that's really just listen. What you're listening for, though, is what they're experiencing and authentically understanding them. And the authentic part is important because you want to actually form a relationship with your counterpart. Then you actively listen. So active listening is trying to really gather those key insights that are going to help you more deeply understand and start to point towards doing something. You might ask a how question like, how do you feel about this? Or what are the biggest problems that you're facing at work, at home, whatever? And then you proactively listen, where you start to point towards actually fixing things. So you might say, well, how do you want to proceed? And as you're doing all these things, you're listening, forming a relationship. And when you feel heard, you're so much more inclined to work with somebody. By contrast, think about that time when you were talking to like a friend, family member, whoever, and you're just pouring your heart out. And they say, can you repeat that? It's, oh my God, crushing. So you listen, and people think that the person talking is in control of the conversation, the listener is, because when you're listening, the person you're talking to is just dumping all this information at you. And if you can collect it and figure out where to press on things, and in the policy space, super important, because we think, conservatives, progressives, there's no overlap. And on so many issues, there is. So if you can just listen and look for it, you can find opportunities to work with people that you never thought in a million years you could possibly work with.
Okay, but that's complicated, in part because I know from reading your book that when you're talking with someone, a lot of the communication is nonverbal. The words that you choose, the points that you make just are less important than how you make them, what you're saying, the resonance and implications behind your words.
Emotional intelligence is foundational to everything in this book, and I think everything in persuasion and everything in our personal relations. So there's the words you say, and there's everything else that goes on top of that, which you just pointed to. Some of those things are your tone. So I have a chapter in the book called Go Beyond Words, because you think, well, if I just get the words right, well, if I get the words right and the tone wrong, if I say, James, that's such a great idea, there's enthusiasm there. And if I say, James, that's such a great idea, same words, totally different tone. And if I roll my eyes in contempt, man, I'm really getting at you. That's the body language. So things like tone, body language, likability, because it so often happens that if we simply read the words anonymized, we might agree with somebody on something. And once we know it's from that person, maybe that we're frustrated with or we don't like or whatever, then actually we change our mind about things just because that person is saying it. So the flip side of that is if you're likable, it greases the wheels of persuasion. So it's not just about getting the words right. It's about this bundle of other things beyond words that are extremely impactful.
Many salespeople are trying to get to yes. You recommend trying to get to no. What's the deal there?
Yeah. So just think about the last time you got a call, you went into a store and they're like, hey, don't you want to buy this? And you felt cornered. And that's really unpleasant. So, and this is something that actually Jim Camp, negotiation expert, he has a book called Start With No. It's a great book. So I kind of grab it from there. That no is actually empowering because when you invite somebody to say no to something, they feel like they have choice and say, and that they're kind of standing up for themselves. So saying no is actually really powerful. And that's one of the big things that people in sales, whether you're selling toothpaste or you're selling a policy idea, instead of saying, don't you agree with this? You just flip it and say, well, do you disagree with this? Would you be opposed to supporting this policy? And then instead of just making them say yes, they're going to say either, no, I'm not opposed, or they're going to say, I'm not opposed, but, and then they'll let you know what their hangup is. Because a lot of what you're looking for is actually somebody's hangup. One of the biggest errors people make with persuasion is that they think it's about getting somebody to do something. And much more often, it's about removing barriers to action. Because if there is something stopping you up here, there's a block, and you don't remove that barrier, then you're not going to share action with me. So I have to know what that barrier is. And when you flip it, people start to let you know what some of those barriers are. Look, no, I'm not opposed, but how are we going to pay for this? No, I'm not opposed, but, where are insert interest group on this? I'm not opposed, but you know, I have some other priorities and I don't know if I can juggle all of these things. Well, those are totally different buts. And if you don't know what that but is and what that barrier is, then they're not going to do what you want them to do, which means you can't get what you want.
That's pretty clever because it's, if you're asking someone if you're going to be on their side, there's some trepidation there. Yep. But it is, are you automatically opposed to my side? Well, there's a lot more conversation that you can have on that position.
Yeah. Absolutely. Because then they can hedge a little bit in a way that's super helpful for you. You're like, look, are you categorically opposed to reducing occupational licensing burdens? Are you categorically opposed to trying to reduce property taxes, whatever? They're like, look, no, I'm not categorically opposed, but, and then that but is gold because then you know, okay, well, are they authentically willing to engage me in conversation? Can I remove that barrier or no, it's impossible. I'm not categorically opposed, but, and then their seven caveats show that, no, they really are categorically opposed. That's also helpful because part of persuasion is knowing when you can't work with somebody. So it's moving on and saving your most valuable resource, which is your time.
All right. So you have an awful lot of recommendations, some ideas that can help people get what they want. How do you get practice? How do you get those repetitions in so that it becomes habit, which I assume is what you need to actually implement this effectively?
100% train and then trust your training. So everything that is in the book, you try out in low stakes situations and you do so authentically and not in an effort to manipulate people. So let's take an example. Maybe we're going to get this later, but I'll just kind of grab it now. Persuasion actually starts with feelings. So just ask people how they feel about things. So you practice these things, the no orientation. Just practice that with your friends, your mom, your kids, whoever. Are you opposed to this? Would you be against this? Do you mind? Is it totally silly to ask? These sorts of things, just invite no. And at first these things feel really awkward, a little bit scary. Can I really put them first? Like really? And then you try it and then you start to see, oh, it's effective. Oh, this is good. So that when you, instead of talking to your friends, have to talk to your boss or you're talking to a lawmaker or somebody else who's really influential, which is, that's like a little bit scarier. You know, okay, I've trained. And then you trust your training. And because it worked before, you know, it's going to probably work now.
One of the things that you cover in the book is trying to persuade people who have fundamentally different sentiments, different things that they care about, you know, from conservatives to libertarians to progressives. There's just a different frameworks for living in the world. That's hard to theorize what another person who cares about different things, you know, fundamentally cares about, what would appeal to them. So how do you do it?
It's simple, not easy, I would say. So let's maybe start by thinking about it this way. Would you force feed a vegetarian veal?
No, it would be horrified.
Yeah, horrified. Would you force feed somebody who keeps kosher bacon? They'd also
no.
be, it's like deeply offensive, right? It's deeply offensive. Okay, so it's kind of how our values work, which this sounds totally crazy. So let me explain and then offer some support for it. And then we can kind of dive into to how you do that. So just like we have certain tastes on our tongue, 5 or 6, sweet, salty, sour, bitter, umami, and possibly oleogustus, which is fat. That's just on our tongue. They're physical taste receptors. Research in moral psychology, people like Jonathan Haidt and others have shown, I think, demonstrably, that we also have wired onto our hearts and minds 6, maybe 7 moral tastes. They are care, essentially sensitivity to harm and suffering. They equity, concern for equal outcomes, proportionality, which is concerned with merit and hard work. Loyalty, which is an in-group, out-group dynamic. Authority, which is respect for hierarchies. Purity, which is basically things that are sacred or not, things that are disgusting or not. And then liberty, which is the ability to do what you want. So these are the 7 tastes that they've found are, you know, they are universal. So the challenging part about that first is, I think it's fun, is that these tastes are to a large degree wired into us. 30 to 60% of our morals is genetic, and they know this through studies of twins. I know it sounds crazy, so people can check the citations in the book. So even better. People with different political ideologies tend, on average, to sort and are sensitive only to certain moral values and moral tastes. So folks on the left are primarily sensitive to care, equity, and a certain kind of liberty, more of a positive liberty, sort of support for being able to do things, say like a welfare program. Conservatives, by contrast, are not sensitive to care and equity. They're sensitive instead to proportionality, liberty, loyalty, authority, and purity. Libertarians have a narrower moral palette than the conservative, but they share the overlap of liberty and proportionality. So since there's no overlap here, right, this is where it gets really hard. So when a conservative is making conservative appeals to a progressive, those are just things that either they don't, you know, it doesn't resonate, or they might even find those things offensive. So to appeal to their values, don't feed the vegetarian veal, feed the vegetarian a tasty salad or, you know, a tasty vegetarian Indian dish or whatever they like, whatever spices it is.
Can you give me an example of that and of how you'd use that in a policy context?
Yeah. So let's take occupational licensing. I think that occupational licensing is a government permission slip to work, and I think that these burdens are unfair, that they're way too large, they're oftentimes unnecessary. So how would I frame that, the recommendation to reduce or eliminate these burdens to folks on the left versus folks on the right? So remember, the folks on the left, they're sensitive to care and equity. So I would make claims about how this policy is uncaring and inequitable. So what does that look like? And I will reach for data. I'm not just making things up. So data from the Fed in Minneapolis show that occupational licensing burdens fall disproportionately on Blacks and Hispanics by like a really wide margin. So the consequences of these burdens literally are, by definition, inequitable. And that is uncaring towards these groups. So I say occupational licensing burdens are inequitable and they're uncaring. They hurt the groups they're meant to help. If I'm talking to conservatives or libertarians, by contrast, I will talk about how these burdens are infringing on somebody's freedom to work in a particular space, and that hard work and merit should determine whether you succeed, not whether you were able to, say in the case of barbering, go through 1,500 hours of cosmetology school and $20,000 and a year of your life. That's not fair. So the same recommendation, reduce or eliminate these burdens packaged differently based on people's moral palates.
What's the difference between the techniques that you teach and manipulation?
The authenticity and the intentions. So great question. People are like, well, isn't this manipulation? It's like the Force in Star Wars, right? Dark side, light side. Or it's like a knife, right? In the hands of a chef with like 3 Michelin stars, he can prepare one of the most beautiful meals in the world for you. It's just this amazing, brilliant thing. Knives can also be used to do great harm to people. So what are your intentions? Are you attempting to share action with somebody so that they're voluntarily working with you towards something that makes you both better off? Or are you trying to twist and turn them? And there are, again, to go back to the missionary-mercenary thing, missionary-mercenary reasons to not manipulate. The missionary reason is that it's wrong. Do you like it when people manipulate you? And the mercenary reason is that it's going to come back to bite you hard, because people, like, our intuitions are really powerful. So people usually find out pretty quickly that you're trying to manipulate them. They just kind of feel it. And that means you're not going to get what you want. Or if they find out that you actually did manipulate them, they're going to A, do everything they can to pay you back, and B, they're going to tell other people. So your reputation is done. It's destroyed. So don't manipulate. Instead, the authenticity is important. When you're trying to demonstrate understanding of somebody, I understand what you care about. And us working together is meant to also get you what you want, not just what I want.
Okay. So I guess what I'm hearing is that, like, you're trying to get to a win-win. An authentic person really does win and really does help the other person win. You can use these techniques to try and make it appear, at least at the moment of decision, that it is a win-win, but it all turns out that it's someone just trying to get you to do something, regardless of whether it does help you or not. Is that a good summary?
Yeah, and look, I mean, part of it is that I really encourage people to think long-term. So if you're on the policy space and you kind of manipulate a lawmaker to, like, support your bill in one instance, but they find out that you manipulated them, they're never going to work with you again. So what you're thinking is not just how do I get what I want one time from somebody? How do I get that time after time after time after time? That's the goal, so that you're, in this sense, quote unquote, winning repeatedly.
A lot of the books is about personal request, you know, getting the right kind of help from colleagues, getting a discount from customer service, yeah, getting your kids to get dressed on time. Now, this is very important. Most of my interactions is by writing 700-word editorials to try and convince strangers who are in no obligation to read what I wrote.
Yeah.
How can your book help me?
A couple things. First, think long-term, and you're trying to build a relationship with somebody. So there is a progressive newspaper in town, and I'm a free market guy. Pretty easy to figure that out. And initially, this person would not really respond to our emails. And over the course of a number of op-eds, sending things that I tailored to her specifically and to her audience specifically that she liked, I formed a relationship where she went from not responding to us to quickly responding to me and saying, oh yeah, this looks great, a couple of tiny edits. That happened because I really understood her and her audience, and I proved it by giving her things. So part of it is think long term, and you're building that relationship so that this lady quickly responds. What are some of the, before you have that relationship, what are some of the sort of tips and tricks you can do? Be hyper-focused on their audience and what they look for so that they're like, oh yeah, this is totally written for us. And then you can use some of these note-oriented things, you know, do you mind if I pitch you on this piece? Is it really silly to ask if you'd be interested in an article about X? Make sure when you're making that appeal, you're understanding their values. you know, there's something in the news and you're like, you know, this seems really unfair, but fair in the way that they understand it. You know, is it a bad idea for me to pitch you, you know, on this story? So you're trying to sort of get them to respond. That's kind of the first step, is getting that response that they see your email and say, oh, okay, yeah, this is written for me. I like this. I'm going to respond to this guy. And then you grow the relationship.
So that's still personal communication, though. Like, you are trying to persuade God. But I'm pretty sure your thing does have lessons for op-ed writing, of things like focus on what your readers might care about. Make sure that you're not just telling people why you care about something, but what they would get out of it. And important things, I think you know, you talk about the importance of storytelling, of having a champion, a hero, a villain, an obstacle that can help your point stick.
Excellent and well taken. I was a bit too narrow in that pre-response, so let me zoom out a little bit. Okay, so what are some of the things from my book that could help somebody write a great op-ed? So it's not just connecting with the editor, which, sorry, that was where my focus was, because I was going to this lady in town who, you know, went from not responding to happily responding. What are some of the biggest things you can do in your policy writing, like an op-ed, to just make it explosive in a really powerful way and dynamic? So a couple of things. Tell stories whenever and wherever possible. Tell stories, because we are story processors before we are logic processors. Maybe your op-ed starts with a story, or maybe a couple of paragraphs in, there's a story there. But better yet, start with a story. For example, one of the things that we've worked on, that I've worked on, is try to reduce the restrictions on accessory dwelling units in Chicago. So what's a great story that I tell? Turns out that one really famous Chicagoan grew up in an accessory dwelling unit that is illegal to build today. And her name was Michelle Obama. So there's a really good story to tell there, because without the opportunity to live in this ADU, Michelle Robinson may never have become Michelle Obama, right? This was a home that her family needed that happened to be available to her. So I start op-eds and things like that with stories like that. Start with a story. That captures people's attention because we're story processors. What's something else you have to do? You have to be for something, because it's easy to see something in the news and criticize it. That's usually the hook for an op-ed. And what's your upshot? What are you for? You don't only want to criticize something. You want to be for something and have that positive tone permeate the op-ed, because, you know, this guy's not usually falling. And even if it is, your job is to catch it and put it back up in the air. So be for something. Make sure that if you're writing for the Wall Street Journal versus the New York Times, that the moral appeals that you make are different. Because those op-eds, even if they say the exact same thing, they need to resonate with the audience. So if it's a left of center versus right of center, we've already talked about that. Make sure that there are some appeals there, especially early on, that resonate with them. So those are, I think, three of the biggest things you can do to bring into your writing that's going to make it a lot more dynamic, and it's just going to resonate with people better. All grounded in lots of neuroscience.
Okay, but why be positive when we know also from neuroscience that outrage is what gets people engaged?
Yeah. So take a look around, and it's pretty obvious what kinds of feelings are persuasive. It's negative feelings, right? When I was writing the chapter in the book on positivity, I looked at Fox and MSNBC, their homepages, and I found from about 200 homepage articles, only one that was positive. It was a story about school choice. So it makes sense too, because we're wired to be negative. We have something called negativity bias. I would ask you though, if you think about the most persuasive Americans, say of the last 100 years, who are some of the people who come to mind?
So, I mean, I'm kind of a nerd. So Milton Friedman is one of the,
I love Milton Friedman.
But Milton is the kind of person who appeals to me. Although, like, part of his shtick is that he does try to respond to the strongest objections of his opponents, but I don't know that he always responds in a persuasive way. It could just be he's playing on my own sentiments.
Well, so let's come back to Milton Friedman, because I think he's also a really good example. Three of the most common answers that people give when I say who are the most persuasive people of, say, the 20th century, the last 100 years, they say JFK, they say Martin Luther King Jr., they say Ronald Reagan, and they all have something in common. They were positive. They were for something. They were happy warriors. People never say Walter Mondale. They never say Malcolm X. They never say Barry Goldwater. So when you think about the most persuasive people who really got what they wanted, right? They form movements that decades later, people are like, no, that, right? They were for something. I think even Milton Friedman, he was for things. I mean, free to choose. That's the TV series and the book. They're phenomenal. And ultimately, he was for these things. He was for freedom and all of the great things that freedom brought to people. All the wonders. His little 2 minute and 10 second video or whatever it is, iPencil, I mean, is just like the wonder that captures his voice throughout that, and the wonder of the price system and the wonder of what that creates. I mean, it's both mind-blowing and beautiful. And so he is for these kinds of things. Of course, at times you're going to be critical of things, especially if you think that, say, the status quo is unfair or it's hurting somebody or whatever. Milton Friedman was for a lot of things, though.
So if you're running for office, you are not going to convince your opponent to vote for you. Like, there's just some things that you can't persuade people to do. What are the limits?
So you can't work with everyone. You're not going to get everyone to share action with you. So part of it's figuring out who might or who will versus who won't. And if you're a politician, running for office, I think you are trying to do three things. The one is to motivate the folks who you know agree with you to support you and to act. The second thing is to identify folks who are maybes and then appeal to them. And then what you can also do is at least try to reduce the likelihood that those who disagree with you oppose you, because it could be simply that you're an elected official and you just want some folks on the other side of the aisle to not oppose what you're doing. They don't have to support it, but maybe they can just not oppose it. So all these things are a little bit different. And I think there's a lot of overlap here. So the things that you're for with people who support you and the things that you're for with people who are maybes, that might look a little bit different. Right. So the things, you know, if you think about politicians, say on the left and the right, the maybes tend to be somewhere in the middle. So you may have to moderate some of your claims a little bit, maybe not, you know, be as, you know, like kind of on one side or the other, but really understanding the middle and what's going to resonate with them. How do they feel about things? What do you need to be for? What are their values? How do you appeal to those values? And how do you capture that in stories? Those folks in the middle who are maybes, target them and then figure out what are the biggest concerns or frustrations with the folks who disagree with you and try to diffuse them, because then either maybe they won't oppose your legislation or maybe they'll just sit this one out because they're not all that keen on the person who seems to be on their side, but they don't dislike you enough to, you know, vote against you. So, hey, like not voting for somebody who for your opponent politically, that's also success. They just, you know, eh.
All right. Let's say that your book is a wild success. You have convinced America to care about what other people care about, look for win-win situations, shared actions, all the kind of things that you're preaching. How does the country look different?
I think the first thing that's different is that we return to true conversations in the political space and elsewhere. We are awash in toxic polarization. The Pew survey, I think it was 2% of people had a positive word to say about our politics, and 79%, I think, percent of it of people had a negative word. One of the most popular responses was actually dumpster fire, which is insane. So part of it is just putting the dumpster fire out and understanding that people have different values. That's okay. We can talk about these things and that it doesn't need to be all toxic and all negative. Because, you know, go back to our founding. America was founded on persuasion. There was a convention. They were holed up for 4 months. They came out with this document. Not everybody got what they wanted, but it was an amazing and beautiful document. And then they went out and they advocated for it. So part of it is stepping away from the polarization back to what America is founded on, which is free speech and persuasion. So that would be like the biggest meta thing. And then kind of beyond that, I think people would just create so much more value in their personal and their professional lives with this approach, whether it's with your kids, your spouse, your parents, your friends, whoever, really authentically understanding the other person and working with them as opposed to next to them or against them gets you what you want way more often. So just creating a lot more value in sales, right? This is super applicable to sales. A lot of salesmen, they go and they say, hey, isn't this great? You should buy this. It's like, I don't know, maybe I don't want that. If you understand your counterpart, whether you're selling toothpaste or a policy or whatever, you're going to sell a lot more stuff. That's creating more value for other people.
All right. Help me out with this closing one then. What is a no question that you can ask to help a person consider your book?
To consider my book? A good no question. That's a great question. Let me think about the best one. See, I should have this ready. I mean, there are so many that are running through my mind. What's the best one? I mean, you would ask, basically what you're trying to do is not to corner them into saying, yes, I want to buy your book, but rather, you know, seeing if they're interested in the topic. So the no oriented question could be something like, you know, is it silly to ask if, you know, you'd like to learn more about persuasion? Or is it silly or crazy to ask? Or would you be opposed to, you know, checking out my book to help you get what you want? They're like, well, no, tell me more. And then what's the more? Because you're looking for that follow-up. You could also ask an open-ended question, a how or what question, you know, like, when was the last, or just even this question, like, when was the last time you felt like you said all the right things, you just couldn't persuade someone? And they're like, oh, that was last night. Okay, well, like, what happened? So that's being another way. But yeah, those no oriented questions, that's probably where I would start.
Excellent. Well, Josh, good luck on your attempts to shift the Overton window and help people be more persuasive.
Thank you, James. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Overton Window, a podcast from the Mackinac Center. Please subscribe and rate. For more, check us out at www.mackinac.org. That's Mackinac with a C, like the island.